I'm Christopher Lydon with the foreign policy realist, so-called John Mearsheimer, confronting what he sees as a surreal world and a whole range of no-win situations for the United States and President Obama. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. John Mearsheimer, you're over my desk forever in a New York Times ad that you organized and signed in September 2002, headline, "War with Iraq is not in the United States' security interest." So I knew you from the beginning as an outspoken, unconventional voice, even before that book you co-authored on the Israel lobby. Toward the end of 2010, here we are, 2 years into the Obama administration. Bring us up to date.
Well, just to go back to Iraq, in the fall of 2002, when the Bush administration first began to ramp up the campaign to invade Iraq, I found it hard to believe that they would seriously contemplate doing this. It just seemed like such a crazy idea. You want to remember that in 1991, we were faced with the possibility of going to Baghdad, and then Secretary of Defense Cheney and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Colin Powell made it perfectly clear that that would be a very foolish idea because we would end up in an endless occupation. I assumed that most people still understood that was the case in the fall of 2002. But slowly but steadily, it dawned on me that I was wrong. And I began talking to a handful of other security experts, especially Steve Walt, who was then at Harvard, and Shibley Telhami, who was at the University of Maryland. And we decided to organize an ad and put it in the New York Times. So we raised $38,000 for a quarter-page ad on the op-ed page of the New York Times. And I think it's sad to say this, but I think that time has proven that our analysis of why it was a bad idea to invade Iraq has proved correct. And, of course, it's not had a positive effect on any of the signatories. I shortly thereafter, with Steve Walt, wrote an op-ed that appeared in the New York Times. It was in February 2003, again arguing against the war. But that was the last op-ed I've ever published in the New York Times. So despite the fact that the 33 people on that who signed that ad were correct about what was going to happen in Iraq, we don't seem to have received much benefit from that.
That to me is part of the strangeness of the whole thing. I mean, you become famous in other dimensions too, but it was not a good career move to be right on that subject.
Well, I think that Les Gelb, who was the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, hit the nail right on the head. And let me just tell you a story there. Steve Walt and I went to the Council on Foreign Relations in New York in February of 2003. This is right before the war. And we debated Max Boot and Bill Kristol, who were in favor of the war. And Les Gelb was the moderator. And we had a vote after the debate, and Steve and I clearly won when you counted the hands that went up in our favor in the audience. And Les Gelb, who was in favor of the war, said to us after that debate, on a number of occasions after that, that Steve and I had wiped the floor with Kristol and Boot. So my question was, why did Les Gelb favor the war if he thought that Steve and I had made a compelling case against the war? Well, recently, Les Gelb revealed that, and he's put this in writing, that the reason he supported the war because it was necessary to maintain his street credibility inside the foreign policy establishment. Mm. In other words, he indicated that he knew that the war was not a good idea, but he backed it anyway because he felt that if he opposed the war, it would do damage to his career. He would lose influence. And I think lots of people came to that conclusion. And that's why remarkably few members of the foreign policy establishment spoke out loudly and clearly against that war. There were a lot of people who were opposed to the war privately, but they did not want to stand up and yell from the rooftops that this was a bad idea. I mean, a good example of this is Brent Scowcroft. He wrote in 2002, in the second half of 2002, an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that said that the war was not a good idea.
This is Papa Bush's old security advisor.
Yes, right, Brent Scowcroft, General Scowcroft. And Condoleezza Rice then called him up and chewed him out. And what did Brent Scowcroft then do? He remained silent. Here's a man, right, a retired general, a former national security advisor, who believes that the United States is about to pursue a boneheaded policy. And simply because an old friend of his, an old colleague of his, who's now in the Bush administration, called him up and told him to zip his mouth, he zipped his mouth. And I think that behavior was not unusual. And when you think about how Scowcroft behaved and you think about how Les Gelb behaved, it's no accident that the neoconservatives and the Bush administration were able to take us into this foolish war.
Bring us up to date, John Mearsheimer. 2010, we have a new president on a slogan of change you can believe in. Review that scene in Iraq, but also Afghanistan and the Middle East in general. Where are we?
Well, I think that President Obama inherited four problems from President Bush that basically have no solution. I think in Afghanistan, there's no way we can win that war. I think with regard to Iraq, we're destined to lose that war as well.
Lose meaning?
Meaning that we will eventually have to pull out, and when we pull out, there will be serious trouble in each of those countries. I think in the case of Afghanistan, the Taliban will come back into power either in Kabul or in some large chunk of the country. And I think in the case of Iraq, when we eventually pull out, the centrifugal forces that have torn that country apart in recent years will come back to cause all sorts of problems. And I think that's why there'll be great pressure on Obama to remain in Iraq at the end of 2011 when he's supposed to pull out all American forces. With regard to Iran, I think there's no way we're going to force the Iranians to shut down their nuclear enrichment program, which is the goal of the United States. And with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, there we're trying to get a two-state solution, but that's not going to happen either. Obama's not able to put any pressure on the Israelis to move to a two-state solution.
What do you mean he's not able?
Well, because of the power of the lobby in this country, there's no way any American president can get the Israelis to do anything that they don't want to do vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And the Netanyahu government was elected on the platform that they would not pursue a two-state solution and indeed would continue to expand the settlements in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank more generally.
That's one way of stating the case. Isn't it just as true to say that Israel cannot thrive and even Israeli political leadership can't thrive without a harmonious, deep understanding with the United States and its government?
Well, the fact is that Israel has a special relationship with the United States that is due in large part to the influence of the Israel lobby. And there's no evidence that in the near future there's going to be any erosion of that special relationship. So Israel can tell Barack Obama to take a leap, and they won't suffer any consequences. Barack Obama will simply go out and take a leap. Remember, when Obama came to power in January 2009, immediately thereafter, he and his principal lieutenants, to include Hillary Clinton, told the Israelis, they told the Netanyahu government that they had to cease all building in the occupied territories, and that included East Jerusalem as well as the West Bank. And a big battle ensued, but by September of 2009, roughly 8 months later, what happened was that Netanyahu won and Obama conceded defeat. And the reason is that the lobby moved in. The Israeli government made contact with its friends in the lobby, and they put huge pressure on Obama to back off and to not put pressure on Netanyahu to stop building settlements. So the end result here is you're going to end up with a greater Israel that is effectively an apartheid state. Many people argue, and the argument I think is quite compelling, that Israel is already an apartheid state. This makes absolutely no sense from Israel's point of view.
Well, that's just what I was going to say. This is a victory for whom? For how long? And you know, at what depth? At what price?
Well, Ehud Olmert, who was the predecessor of Benjamin Netanyahu as Prime Minister of Israel, said that if you don't get a two-state solution, that Israel will end up in a South Africa-like situation. What former Prime Minister Olmert was saying was that Israel would end up as an apartheid state.
He then and went a pariah nation.
Yes,
is the
and indeed, Chris, he went on to say that if that happens, that will be the end of Israel. Those were his words, because he understands, I believe correctly, that there's no way that Israel can exist as an apartheid state. Okay. So that was former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Former Prime Minister Ehud Barak has said that if Israel doesn't get a two-state solution, you'll end up with an apartheid state. Zippy Livni, the former foreign minister, who actually got more votes than Prime Minister Netanyahu in the last election, believes it's imperative to create a Palestinian state to avoid turning Israel into a South Africa. But the fact of the matter is that the Netanyahu government and increasing numbers of people in Israel don't buy that logic. And they think that they can continue to colonize the occupied territories and depend on the lobby to get the United States to protect them, the Israelis. It's very important to understand that Israel could not get away with its behavior towards the Palestinians if it wasn't for the power of the lobby in the United States. The lobby puts huge amounts of pressure on any American government to back Israel no matter what it does. So we have what I think is a rather bizarre situation where the lobby is working hand in hand with Israel to put Israel in a situation where its long-term future is in jeopardy. And I think that Obama, who is often criticized by hardline American Jews and hardline Israelis as being an enemy of Israel, is actually a true friend of Israel. What he would like to do is save Israel from itself. But again, it's almost impossible to do that in large part because of the power of the lobby.
I'm so glad you mentioned Les Gelb at the beginning. Colleague of mine on the New York Times years ago, good friend, reasonable guy. But as you said, he knew better than to believe in the war in Iraq, but he couldn't violate the club rules and oppose it. What are smart people like that thinking about these four areas you mentioned, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, and the Israel-Palestine confrontation, that they're not saying? What are they really thinking, even President Obama, about these predicaments?
Well, I think at this point in time, almost everybody in the foreign policy establishment understands that we are in deep trouble with regard to each of those four problems. That's Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I think everybody understands it. I think if Les Gelb were here, he would not make the argument that we have simple fixes for any of those problems.
I think the man on the street understands it. I think children understand it.
Well, the best way to understand this, I think, Chris, is to remember that a fundamental shift took place during the Bush administration. In the first term, the Bush administration employing big stick diplomacy, running around the world threatening all sorts of people and then invading Iraq and before that Afghanistan, got the United States into a heap of trouble. By 2004, it was clear to almost everybody that the United States was in serious trouble. So in the second Bush administration, you had a fundamental transformation in how Washington thought about the broader world. And Condoleezza Rice was brought in as Secretary of State. Dick Cheney, the vice president's role in the making of foreign policy diminished significantly. Donald Rumsfeld was replaced by Bob Gates. And in effect, the pragmatists were in charge. Now, during that second Bush administration, which of course lasted 4 years, President Bush and his lieutenants tried to solve those four big problems, and they failed. They failed for one very simple reason. There is no good solution to any of those four problems. And what President Obama inherited was those same four problems, and not surprisingly, he can't figure out how to solve them for the same reason that President Bush in his second term couldn't solve them, and that is that there is no solution. And that is why we are in so much trouble. And all of this points up just how much trouble was caused during that first Bush administration, which I think was the most radical and reckless foreign policy the United States has ever pursued.
Whose responsibility is it, John Mearsheimer, to tell the people, to tell the world, we're in a variety of dead ends and we're going to seek some new courses here?
Well, I think that Barack Obama could have done that in the spring of 2009 or maybe the summer of 2009, a few months after he took office. Indeed, I think if he were smart, what he would have done was...
Well, he is smart, but go ahead.
Well, he's smart in some ways, but not smart in others. You want to remember, he's not a very experienced man. He was not a former governor. He's never run a large organization. He was a senator for a brief period of time from the state of Illinois. And he doesn't know that much about foreign policy. Foreign policy has not been his strong suit over time. And he walked into a situation where he inherited some really wicked problems. And by the way, those foreign policy problems were not the greatest of his problems. The greatest problem he faced was the American economy. And he's not been able to fix that one either. So he has a lot of really big issues on his plate.
Come back to what he might have announced.
Yes. But nevertheless, I think that what he should have done after taking office or shortly after taking office is he should have gone on television and he told the country that, look, I ran on the platform during the campaign that I could change things and fix things all for the good in a relatively short period of time. We had simple solutions. But now that I've surveyed the menu of problems that are in front of the country and talked to the experts about what can and can't be done, it's manifestly clear to me that most of these problems are extremely difficult, if not impossible, to solve. And what we have to do is we have to lower our expectations, and we have to understand that there are no simple fixes. That's what he should have said, and that would have protected him. It would have been, in a certain way, a prophylactic speech where he would have protected himself against all the promises that he had made in the campaign and all the optimism that was in the air at the time. But, of course, what happened was that he continued to talk as if he could solve these problems, but he's been unable to fix them because these problems are not fixable. And the end result is that lots of people are angry at him. They think that he promised and then he didn't deliver.
What do you do with unfixable problems?
Well, in the case of Afghanistan, we're eventually going to have to walk away. There's going to come a point where people are going to realize that this is hopeless and we paid an enormous cost and then we walk. But as you know, great powers like the United States don't like losing. They have tremendous resources and we'll probably hang on for a long time before we finally walk away. But we will eventually walk away and it will be a defeat. With regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, just to pick another example, as I said, I don't think you're going to get a two-state solution. I think the peace process is a charade, and the end result is that you're going to get a greater Israel, and that greater Israel is going to be an apartheid state. And that is going to be obvious to almost every educated person on the planet, and it's going to cause a great deal of uproar in the Arab and Islamic world for sure, but all around the globe. And it's going to cause the United States all sorts of problems, and it's going to cause Israel all sorts of problems. And to put it bluntly, it's going to be a festering sore for American foreign policy, I think, for decades to come. With regard to Iran, I think it's hard to imagine a situation where Iran gives up its nuclear enrichment capability. And I think as time goes by, that nuclear enrichment capability will get increasingly sophisticated, which means they'll be closer and closer to the point where they could easily acquire nuclear weapons if they want. That will cause all sorts of problems with the Israelis and the Americans, and that problem will be festering for a long time to come. The Iraq problem, we're going to come face to face with much quicker because President Obama has promised, and George Bush actually laid the groundwork for this promise, to pull all American troops out by the end of 2011. So probably about 15 or 16 months from now, we should be getting ready to pull all of our troops, not just combat troops, all of our troops out of Iraq. I believe that Iraq is slowly descending back into chaos, and I think at the end of 2011, the situation will look very bleak, and there will be tremendous pressure on Obama to keep the troops in Iraq. And we'll see what he will do. But I would bet that what he'll do is he'll leave a lot of air power there and he'll leave some ground forces as well. And the United States won't have all the troops out by the end of 2011.
John Mearsheimer, you shocked me with what's an obvious point, but I never really dwelt on it, that he doesn't have a single significant foreign policy advisor who opposed the war in Iraq.
Obama himself opposed the war. In fact, it's funny, but the organizers of a big rally in Chicago against the war wanted me to speak there. I was their first choice, and I had agreed to speak at the University of Wisconsin. And because I had made a commitment to the people at Wisconsin, I told the organizers of the Chicago rally that they would have to get someone else. So they asked me about Barack Obama, and I said that I thought that he would be a good second choice. I said that I didn't think he was as good a speaker, public speaker, as I am, but he'd do the job. I'm joking, of course. They did ask me that, and I told them that he would be an excellent choice.
That was where he said, no dumb wars.
Yes, yes, that's correct.
Explain the lapse there. Did he forget that speech?
Well, the problem that Obama faced was that although he was opposed to the war, most of the important figures in the Democratic Party who he could turn to for foreign policy advice were not opposed to the war.
But they were the people he beat.
No, there's no question that he beat them, but beating them is one thing, governing is another thing. And to govern, he needed the Democratic Party's full support, especially since he knew he was going to have to deal with the Republicans. So he had to bring into his administration at the senior level all sorts of advisors who had supported the war and who had basically supported the Bush Doctrine. You want to remember there were not a lot of prominent Democrats who were arguing against the Iraq war before it happened. There were not a lot of prominent Democrats who were arguing against the Bush Doctrine. Very few people spoke out publicly. Very few people in the foreign policy establishment spoke out publicly against the Iraq war. It gets back to our earlier discussion of Les Gelb. I mean, if Les Gelb, who's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, feels that he can't speak out publicly against the Iraq war without losing his street creds, you can imagine how difficult it is for all sorts of other people. For somebody like Hillary Clinton, who wants to be president of the United States, she has to go along with the flow. She has to support the war.
But, John, there's something that doesn't add up here. You're saying he had to embrace a policy that he knew was wrong and that
He had to embrace the policymakers. He had to embrace the Democrats who had supported the war and bring them into his administration as policymakers because there was really nobody else he could turn to. The Democratic Party was complicit in the invasion of Iraq. Barack Obama was an outlier. He was one of the few Democratic politicians who spoke out against the war.
But it's why he got the nomination. It has a lot to do with why he won the office.
Well, again, winning an election and governing the country are two different things. And then once he took office, he began to realize that he could not just cut and run in Iraq or in Afghanistan, for that matter. And what he's chose to do is reduce the American commitment in Iraq and at the same time build up the commitment in Afghanistan. But we'll see what he does at the end of 2011.
You bring us back, though, to your view that we've entered a surreal situation. No good way to solve any of these problems and no good way to get out, not even to change our approach.
Well, there's two points to be made. One is that in the wake of September 11th, the United States pursued a radical and reckless foreign policy in the form of the Bush Doctrine. That at the time I found very hard to understand. I mean, I couldn't believe that such a large portion of the foreign policy establishment would buy on to the Iraq war. I mean, if you think about it, Vice President Cheney and Secretary of State Colin Powell both opposed going to Baghdad in 1991. And here we are in 2002, 2003, and they are both playing key roles in pushing us into going to Baghdad. It's just very hard to understand that. Furthermore, almost all of the individuals who were involved in making the decision to go into Iraq had lived as young adults during the Vietnam War and surely remembered what happened the last time that we tried to do nation building on a large scale in a country like Vietnam. And it didn't work out well then, and I thought there was no reason to think it was going to work out well this time. But so many people seemed to be completely unfazed by the Vietnam comparison. So I think in a very important way, it seemed like we were unhinged at the time. It seemed like we were living in a world where facts and logic didn't seem to matter at all. Just to give you another dimension to this problem, I used to argue at the time, look, if we go into Iraq and we topple Saddam, which won't be difficult to do, the question is who replaces him and what kind of political system are we going to create in Iraq that will enable us to get out so that we won't end up as an occupier and then won't end up generating an insurgency. And the neoconservatives in particular, but most of the people in the war party in general, thought that there was some magical way that the United States was going to get rid of Saddam and then a democratic and stable government was going to sprout up in its place. If you look at the historical record and you look at America's past attempts to impose democracy from outside with military force, we failed in almost every case. The idea that you can easily and quickly create democracy in a country that you invade is simply not a plausible argument. But for some reason, lots of Americans, lots of people in the foreign policy establishment thought that once Saddam was gone, we were going to be able to leave, reload the shotgun, and then put our crosshairs on Iran or Syria, and eventually race through the entire Middle East, transforming them all into democracies. This is what the Bush Doctrine was all about. Most people have now forgotten since we're stuck in Iraq, that the original plan called for transforming not just Iraq, but Iran and Syria and all sorts of other countries in the Middle East. This was a radical scheme like we have never seen before in American history. And not surprisingly, it ended in catastrophic failure. And what we're now trying to do is figure out how to dig ourselves out of this hole. And we can't come up with a clever strategy for doing that. The Bush administration couldn't come up with a clever strategy, and the Obama administration has been unable to come up with a clever strategy. And the reason is quite simple. There is no clever strategy.
So we didn't invade Syria or Iran yet. But from Vietnam to Iraq and now deeper into Afghanistan, I mean, my question is, why are we seeing this movie over and over again?
Well, to give you my view of the situation, I think that after the Vietnam War, the United States lived for decades in fear of finding itself in another quagmire of that sort. This is why in the 1990s, despite all the Clinton administration's talk about nation building and the United States intervening in places like Somalia to do nation building, in the end, we did very little of it. You remember when those American soldiers were killed in Mogadishu in 1993, President Clinton immediately pulled our troops out of Somalia.
As Ronald Reagan had pulled them out of Beirut when the Marines got blown up.
In 1983, that's exactly right. In 1982, we put the Marines in Beirut. In 1983, 241 Marines were killed when a suicide bomber blew up the Marine barracks, and Reagan pulled them out. That's the legacy of Vietnam. What I believe, Chris, changed all that was the Afghanistan War. Between October 2001 and December 2001, it appeared, and I want to underline the word appeared, it appeared that the United States had won a stunning victory in Afghanistan with very few American ground forces and a heavy reliance on local forces, Afghani allies, and American air power. And then after we won the conflict, or what appeared to be a victory, in December of 2001, we installed the Karzai government in Kabul. And it looked like the Karzai government would be able to govern Afghanistan for the long term, and the United States would not have to occupy Afghanistan. In other words, it looked like the United States could win quick and decisive victories in countries in the Arab and Islamic world and then get out quickly and leave behind a stable and friendly government. That was Afghanistan. And it is no surprise, in my opinion, that shortly after Afghanistan, we decided to do Iraq, because the intention was to do in Iraq what we had done in Afghanistan between October and December of 2001. This is why they paid no attention to nation building or thinking about the question of how you were going to foster the spread of democracy in Iraq. They thought that what happened in Afghanistan would effectively happen in Iraq. What they didn't understand is that we really didn't win a meaningful victory in Afghanistan. It was just a temporary victory, or to put it in different terms, it was a mirage. Because the Taliban had not been decisively defeated. Karzai was both corrupt and inefficient, and that meant the Taliban would come back, as it has, and Karzai and his government would be incapable of dealing with it because he is inefficient and corrupt. So actually what Afghanistan was a case of the United States jumping into a quagmire. It just didn't appear that way in December 2001. And that mirage is what allowed us to think we could do Iraq, then we could do Syria, then we could do Iran. We could use the big stick to reorder the Middle East. Of course, what happened is we jumped into Iraq, and that quickly turned into a quagmire. And then slowly but steadily, Afghanistan reverted back to form, and we ended up in two quagmires, which is where we are today. And of course, once Iraq went south, all talk of invading Syria and Iran and using big stick diplomacy to reorder the Middle East disappeared.
We do seem to be terribly slow about picking up on our mistakes here and correcting, and it's a great puzzlement to me. How do you explain it?
I think that at this point in time, the big question in the United States is, how is it that a country with so much intellectual capital could have screwed up not just foreign policy so badly, but the economy as well. The problem here, I think, is much bigger than foreign policy. If you think about it, virtually all of the economists and all of the key business people and all of the key figures who manage the economy and the Clinton administration and the Bush administration all thought that the American economy was in terrific shape, and hardly any of them foresaw the tsunami that hit us in 2008. Something is fundamentally wrong here. Let's go back to the discourse about the Iraq War. The fact that so few people spoke out against the Iraq War, so few prominent people in the national security establishment foresaw a problem here is really quite remarkable. I don't think you had to be very smart to understand that invading Iraq was likely to lead to disaster. You would have thought that at least a substantial number of experts, or so-called experts, would have foresaw that disaster coming, but they did not. So this leaves us with the question, what is wrong in the United States? How is it that a country with all this intellectual capital could have been simultaneously wrong about such fundamentally important issues, the economy and foreign policy? And truth be told, I don't have a good answer.
It's the Michael Lewis question in The Big Short. I mean, the heroes of that book are the strange, eccentric, you know, almost Asperger's, autistic outliers in the financial business who said, this is nuts, we're going to bet against it. And they did. They were the guys, in effect, who signed your ad in the New York Times that said, this is loony, get out. And they bet against it, and they made tons of money, but then they left the business. It didn't – there was something in all that, as you say, unbelievable firepower, not to mention computer power of an analytical variety on Wall Street. It was just plain wrong. And we still haven't explained it.
Yeah. Well, I'd put it in slightly different terms. We all have theories in our head about how the world works. And we had a body of economic theories that underpinned the management of the American economy and the international economy more generally. And the problem was that these theories contained some serious flaws. There's just something wrong. Remember, we came very close to replicating the Great Depression. Barack Obama's best defense these days is not that he fixed things in the sense that we're now in excellent shape. His best defense these days is that he prevented us from going off a cliff. And I think that's true. He did prevent us from going off a cliff. But the mere fact that we were in a position where we almost went off a cliff, that we almost duplicated what happened during the Great Depression, is really quite remarkable. And what's even more remarkable is that hardly anyone foresaw that coming. Now, you point out that in the Michael Lewis book, he identifies a number of people who did see that happening. One question is, why weren't there more people like that? And number two, why wasn't anybody listening to those individuals? Same thing goes with regard to the decision to invade Iraq. Why didn't more people understand just how much trouble we were going to get into? And why weren't the few people who were out there who were arguing that this is a fool's errand listened to in any meaningful way? Why were people who were in charge of both the economy and foreign policy so sure that they had the approved solution? It's a great puzzle.
To me, there's always a media question underlying it all, too. Where were the elders of the Fourth Estate? Where were the people with memory, the grown-ups, the people who are supposed to know the world? And why weren't they saying, this doesn't look plausible to me?
Well, I think in large part because there's just not much independence in the media anymore. Most of the people who occupy positions of influence in the media are so tied into the establishment that they don't feel comfortable questioning the establishment. They just go along with what the establishment thinks is the correct policy. So I don't expect the American media to criticize a president in any meaningful way when it comes to an important foreign policy decision. I mean, presidents can manipulate the media in all sorts of ways. This is what President Bush understood. The American media was like silly putty in his hands. And in fact, he basically used the New York Times and the Washington Post to spread all sorts of untrue stories about the Iraqi threat and to scare the people, American people, into supporting that war. Michael Massing has written a series of superb pieces in the New York Review of Books on the failure of the American media, mainstream media, to deal with the facts in the run-up to the Iraq war.
And yet there are independent voices, even in the New York Times, Paul Krugman among them. But I think he believes with you that we're in a surreal place.
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. He had a column the other day where you could see his exasperation coming out in spades. He's been talking about the various Republican proposals that are out on the table these days for fixing the economy. And he has argued for months now that most of these proposals don't make any sense. When you look carefully at them, they don't add up. It's hard to believe that the Republicans are paying attention to facts and basic logic. I mean, he finds it very hard to understand what's going on here. So in his most recent column, he was referring to the fact that the United States is becoming a banana republic. And I think by that he meant that we are engaged in a discourse that is not reality-based. And if you're engaged in a discourse that's not reality-based, it's very difficult for people like him, and I feel the same way, to engage in serious discourse because facts and logic don't seem to matter. And I think what surprises him and surprises me as well is that the people who are purveying these fairy tales are listened to. They're paid serious attention. And that really does make you wonder.
The Bush administration, Karl Rove, very specifically dismissed the fact-based community, you guys in the fact-based community. How does one re-enter the fact-based community? What is the route for the country back to fact-based reality?
Well, let's just be very clear here. If you're coming up with arguments and policies that are not based on facts, but are based on misinformation, you are asking for serious trouble. Even when we come up with policy prescriptions that are based on real facts, we sometimes get it wrong. Coming up with the right policies to deal with a thorny problem is a tricky business, even when you're in a fact-based or a reality-based world. But if you're not in a reality-based world, you're going to end up in a quagmire in Afghanistan. You're going to end up in a quagmire in Iraq. You're going to end up almost driving the economy, not just the American economy, but the international economy off a cliff. And this is what Karl Rove and George Bush did. Very important to understand that Barack Obama did not create the problems we now face. The Bush administration was in the driver's seat when these problems were created. And the Bush administration had a number of prominent people at the higher levels who believed that they create their own reality. They believed that facts didn't matter. And they were successful at implementing that vision, and we've seen what happened.
John Mearsheimer, you're enormously interesting. I suspect you're right on most of this, but you're not encouraging.
Well, I think we are at a very difficult point in time in our history. I was no great fan of the Clinton administration, but by the time Bill Clinton left office in January 2001, the economy was in terrific shape. We had budget surpluses, as you'll remember. And furthermore, there had been no foreign policy disasters. I mean, Clinton had not been a genius at managing foreign policy, but he had a few successes, and he had managed to avoid any real disasters. When you compare what the country looked like when Clinton left office and when Bush left office in January 2009, it's like night and day. We were in deep, deep trouble in January 2009, and that's the inheritance that President Obama is dealing with. And it's not through, you know, any great lack of intelligence on President Obama's part that he hasn't fixed these problems. It's just that the problems that the Bush administration created, with a considerable amount of help from some Democrats, those problems are just so thorny that it's hard to see how we get out of any of them anytime soon. And that's why I'm so pessimistic. But I think in this case, I'm not the only one who's pessimistic. I think most Americans are quite pessimistic about where we are today. Just to come at this from a slightly different angle, Chris, and to emphasize the foreign policy side of things, if you think back to when the Cold War ended, there was a great deal of optimism in the air here in the United States. Francis Fukuyama wrote his very famous piece, The End of History, which said that liberal democracy had triumphed first over fascism and then over communism, and it had emerged as the dominant political ideology of the future. Frank Fukuyama was basically saying that with the passage of time, more and more countries would be democratic, and that this would be a good thing. The Soviet Union collapsed. Communism was ended in Eastern Europe. And furthermore, the United States came out of the Cold War as a remarkably powerful country. Charles Krauthammer wrote his famous piece, The Unipolar Moment in Foreign Affairs, in 1990-91, which said that the United States is now by far the most powerful state on the planet, and it can use all that muscle for good, and most people believe that. So entering the 1990s, we thought that, you know, the world was our oyster. We were going to do all sorts of wonderful things. And again, even by the end of the Clinton years in early 2001, most people thought that we were really in pretty good shape, and with some fine tuning, we'd be even in better shape. Then came September 11th, and then came the Bush Doctrine, and it's been pretty much all downhill since then. And that's just on the foreign policy side. It's also true on the economic side as well. And we're in real trouble today. It's a lot different situation today than it was in 1989 when the Cold War ended.
John Mearsheimer, thank you so much. We're going to resume this conversation down the road, and we'll check the score again. Thank you.
You're welcome, Chris.
Ben Mandelkern and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.